session number 14974, Paul Armstrong, Reel 17.
Armstrong, Reel 17. How long were you with this works unit, Mr. Armstrong?
Between 3 and 4 months. And then I was posted to the RE depot at Ripon and rebadged from the Derms into the Royal Engineers. But I was only here for a short while. When I went through, oddly enough, can't quite understand why, I went through a basic bridging course, presumably till they fitted me in when I went down to Aldershot to what they call the 3rd Training Battalion of the Royal Engineers.
What is in a basic bridging course? What are you doing?
This basic bridging course was learning the use of cordage, ropes, knots and the rest of it, the use of the various landing craft that could be used on the River Ure at Ripon, and the elements and basics of building the Bailey Bridge. I found it very fascinating, and I was sorry that we were there such a short time. But I was down to go to the training battalion, which was for subaltern officers in the Royal Engineers, and which was a pretty... it was a pretty intensive course. We did everything there, including... training out on Laffin's Plain, Longmoor. We went all over. We did bridging. We did everything. And I was there until October. And I must say that it was an excellent course. They drove us from morning till night. It really was hard work.
This was an officer's course.
An officer's course, sorry. And
so within the course itself, would you be carrying out the tasks which your men would be doing?
Yes, yes. What happened, we were in, you might call it sections, and of 10 officers. And one took it in turn to be in charge for the day. And then another number two, and so on, right through the 10. So that everyone got the opportunity of showing whether he was any good or whether he was no good. And many, many errors were made. But it was a very salutary lesson. And I used to really enjoy it. In fact, at night time, we used to sit and talk it over. We lived weren't all transfers. A lot of us had come from Octu and various other places.
What kind of things were they training you to do?
Everything. You were... Well, first of all, they went back to the basics of the Royal Engineers. You went right through the various units in the Royal Engineers, and there are very, very many. It would take me a long, long time to tell you the number of units in the Engineers. Then we went through the equipment with which the... And of course, there was a sergeant major attached to each of these small syndicates of 10 men. And he was writing down notes the whole of the time. And at the end of the day, one had to to attend lectures in which your performance was graded and talked over, and one learned very, very quickly the things that one had done wrong. I found it very, very interesting, and once again, I would like to have been there longer than I was at Ripon, but the RE had formed the opinion, which I had expressed previously, that the training of a lot of these RE units was, from the military point of view, left a lot to be desired. And I was posted almost overnight to a unit, a corps unit, at a street in Somerset.
What date was this?
This was November 42. They were in a hutted camp there, and they weren't quite as bad as the last unit in that the officers hadn't been recruited from a company. They were all Royal Engineers, as the men were, and it was Army Troops, they called them, Army Troops Company. And they were supposed to be with Army, there's the field engineers, and then behind that for specialist work, there's the Army Troops. And they were an amazing crowd in that they were commanded by a Major Bryden. At that time he became a colonel later, but Major Bryden. And he was a Scots-Canadian who had, I think I'm right in saying, something like 9 civil engineering degrees. An amazing man, who joined up, although he was slightly over the age of one would expect, but his sole interest in life at that time was to win the war. And he did something I've never seen before or since. At the end of each day, he costed the work that had been done to see whether we were showing a profit or a loss on the manpower and equipment used. I've never seen anything like it in my life, and it certainly kept us all right on the ball. The only thing about this unit was, in a similar way, they'd had no training, military training, whatever, and he told me flatly that I'd been sent down because I was an ex-soldier. And his chief insult when he was annoyed with me was to say that I was military-minded. But one could put up a lot with that because they were a happy crowd, and I integrated very quickly. But once again, it was infantry training. The same sort of complaint I got from the others. All these engineers think that they, because of their trade, they were immune from ordinary discipline and ordinary military training. And I told them that not only engineers, but I saw even Royal Air Force people have to take a rifle and standby to repel any sort of trouble. So I tried to console them this way, but they didn't take very kindly to it. However, we got on very well indeed, and before I left, before we left Street, when we came to leave Street, we were going to Plymouth, and this had been bombed, I think, during the war, but this was our next move, and I think we'd only been in Plymouth a fortnight when I was sent up to Ripon on a bomb disposal course presumably because bomb disposal at that time, there were very, very few trained people in that line.
What date was this?
This was in December 42.
So up to now you'd had some brief training on the civil engineering side of the engineers, but the rest of it has been basically regimental training with the engineers.
Exactly. It's very interesting. But in rapid succession, I went... Well, this bomb disposal course was the most interesting, and by sheer chance... No, I'm wrong there. By the fact that I was interested, I learned quite a lot. When you think that you're going to meet bombs and mines and the rest of it, it does concentrate your attention. And there wasn't very many people idling on that course.
What type of bombs at this time were you working on?
Most of the bombs that we worked on were the 1,000-pounders, which the Germans were using quite a lot at that time. The mine, the floating mine that they came down by parachute. Then the rest was the Teller mine, which the Germans used against vehicles, tanks, and the rest of it. Shoe mines. There were quite a few, but the main thing that one had to learn was the fuses. The fuses, 23C, I can remember, they all had German markings and German dates and the rest of it, but one learned very, very quickly that if, for instance, a fuse said ZUG, Z-U-G, you knew there was a booby trap somewhere. And you learn to be very acute. And I must say that I did pay a lot of attention to it. And it was just as well, because in February, I was back with the unit working on a job on the front at Devonport, when there was a heavy air raid, and my colonel was interesting in that he would never wear a steel helmet and he would never take shelter. He assumed that he was fireproof.
What was his name?
His name, strangely enough, was Noel Bryden, and he told me once, as serious as a judge, that he was born on the same day as Jesus Christ, and he thought there was something in it.
You said Bryden there. Is this the same Bryden that was major of the army troops that you were with?
No.
Family.
Oh yes, Bryden. This is what I'm talking about. The company I was still with. I beg your pardon. And this raid came on, and I remember we were billeted on a school in Devonport. And I remember all the officers used to gallop up to the top and watch the planes until it dawned on them that it was shrapnel that was pattering down, and they retreated. And Bryden's amusement, there was so little to do. We used to go into the chemistry lab of this school, and he used to set up a retort and produce neat spirit. Because I must say, he liked to drink, as most Scotsmen do. We didn't do a lot of this, but he showed us how to do it, using potatoes and various other things. In fact, he once bet, and no one took him up on it, I've often wished I had since, that he could make alcohol out of an old boot.
The training on the course that you were on, were you training with live bombs?
At the depot, no. This actually is one of the sort of things that later on I disagreed with. I'll tell you why later.
But were they mock-ups?
We had real fuses which had been made safe. We had real mines. We had that had been picked up. Oh, the Germans had been using them for quite a long time. Some of the equipment we had come from Spain.
So if you were faced with a bomb or a mine, what was the approach they were teaching you to that weapon, to disengage it?
Yes, you have a different technique for every sort of mine. And this was where I think that the average fighting soldier found it difficult to attune himself to. A mine is buried normally. And the first thing one learns from a mine in action, I'm not talking about prepared positions where they usually had a fence, but in action, mines are just laid and covered, hidden, and then the people withdraw. For instance, what we did at Ripon was to go out onto the training ground, provided it was reasonable, and one party would bury various types of mines, and another party would advance. And at that time, as equipment was in short supply, mine detectors were few and far between, certainly couldn't waste them in England when they were needed abroad. We used to do what the infantrymen did, and that is to crawl along the ground using a bayonet held at an angle and prodded into the ground. This was all the infantry had at this time to find where mines were. And you can imagine a row of men prodding away, and then you feel something hard underneath. It's usual to have the handle of whatever you're using in the palm of the hand, and you feel this. When you first start, stones, metal, anything feel the same, but like everything in life, practice makes perfect. And if you live long enough, you can tell what sort of a mine even it is that you're up against.
Was this a safe method?
Nothing's safe when you're looking for mines, because in addition to the mine, the Germans used to put booby traps underneath, which meant when you tried to lift the mine, there was another one underneath, which when you lifted it, you pulled a pin out and the mine went off. So, no, it isn't a very safe way, but it's the only way. And I found that as far as the infantry were concerned, mines were the only thing that frightened them.
This would be because of their unknown, you don't know, this their is invisibility.
Precisely, it's the unknown that frightens most people. And as far as telemines are concerned, that was much easier because you had a bigger piece of equipment. But in the case of shoe mines, which were made of wood and plastic working parts, it wasn't easy. And so you had very gently to try and clear round about and expose the mine, and then gingerly feel under to see if there was a booby trap. So slowed you up very considerably, and this is what the enemy wanted, either to go back to prepared positions or to turn his guns onto you, one or the other.
So you work in effect from the surface of the soil downwards.
That's
once
right.
You'd contacted round it. The mine.
Yes, just round it.
And then you had to feel underneath something.
Feel
else.
Underneath if you had the time.
It's a very, very slow process.
Very slow process. And don't forget, normally the minefield would be approached from three or four positions, depending on what was required and how many men were up forward. And you might find, for instance, on a battalion front, you might find three lanes cleared. When I say lanes, I mean literally roads. You can picture a road about the width of well, the width of a tank with a man on each side. And the man on the right, the sapper, the Royal Engineer, on the right-hand side, behind him had a man unrolling a white tape and pegging it down as he went on. And the man on the left of this road lane had equally another. And lanes were marked through the minefield for the tanks, armoured cars and other vehicles to come through. The rest of it was left and marked mines.
So in early 1943, which is about the time we're talking about, you were training to work on the mines the Germans had at that time.
That's right.
What mines did they have? What experiences did people have of their mines at that time?
Not a lot, because when I eventually went out to France in 44, I found a mine that had been developed by the French in pre-war days, before 39, and it had never been found before, a French rupture, Olivia. And I made a note of it at once and sent it up to Corps headquarters, where hopefully it did some good.
Battlefield mines, after all, the only fighting was going on in the desert.
At that time, yes.
So the mines that they were encountering there
were mainly teller mines, shoe mines and S mines.
And examples of those were coming for you to
yes.
work with.
But at that time, when the Germans and the British met, the S mine wasn't very well known. And this is the jumping mine, the three-pronged one that leaps, and it caused a lot of consternation amongst the troops in the early 42-3 time.
How did that operate?
Spring inside. It was almost like a soup tin, a tin of soup. But out of the top projected a rod which had three prongs sticking from it. Normally you buried the mine so that just the prongs were showing above the surface. And often people put bits of rubbish on that even. So that when the chap came along, he stood on it, and as he stepped forward, it leapt into the air, exploded, and there's something like 300 either ball bearings or pieces of shrapnel inside it. And it caused havoc, as it leapt to a height of about 4 feet. The shoe mine was very, very much smaller. It was purely anti-personnel amongst the anti-tank mines, just to blow, just to demoralise troops. It blew feet off, things like that.
You wouldn't have an anti-tank mine field on its own. You'd have this mixture, would you?
Quite. It was, obviously, if it was an anti-tank mine field alone, it would be too easy. And, in fact, I met anti-tank minefields where one could pick out, by walking round the field, one could pick out three or four datum points and sit down and plot the whole field, because the German is very methodical.
I was going to ask you, was there a pattern to every minefield they laid, in effect?
Not always, but on coast defence, there were a lot that went to pattern. And in fact, where I was moving up in the Calais, Boulogne, Dunkirk area, I felt I knew the engineer that had been in charge of the troops that had laid this mine, because he did exactly the same things. You see, if you trained in mine lifting, you have also to remember that the man who's laying it, he's got the same problems as you got. And therefore you think, what would he do here? You find his simple example. You come to a static minefield as opposed to a minefield that you find in a battle. A static minefield almost inevitably had wire fence around it, barbed wire fence around it. That was mainly to stop the Germans from falling into their own minefields. But of course, the purpose of a minefield is to channel the attacking troops into the paths that you want them to go, where you've got weapons on fixed lines permanently covering them. So these minefields, I used to walk around, find the datum points, which were posts, just ordinary branches of trees cut to about 3 foot and protruding from the ground about 12-15 inches. A piece levelled on it, the bark taken off, and a number put on, 1, 2, 10, 12, or whatever. And then walking around the minefield, you found others till eventually you found the corresponding post, and you knew then you had one datum line. And I used to mark, as I walked around, I used to mark it and then get all the datum marks, trace them all out, and then start, move into the minefield and start looking for the mines. This in war was when we had mine detectors.
Yes, we'll come to talk about the detectors. So in effect, the German minefield would be marked in a way that, so the Germans knew where it was.
That's right. That was the
idea. And whilst you also knew where it was because of that, you still had it to clear.
Yes, later.
How deep might a minefield be?
Oh, on the coast, you could have I've had them about 100 yards front and going back to a similar sort of distance. I've had narrow ones, widening out, various shapes. This, as I say, is why I always walked to minefield and used to check it. The only drawback to that was the German often used to fasten booby traps to the perimeter fence so that if you walked along, you might put your foot on a shoe mine, or you might catch a wire which is attached to another mine somewhere. So even there you had to be careful. But what I did, and I expect all other officers did on mine lifting, I used to look to see if there was any, for instance, telemines were brought up in certain carriers. You've seen the pallets that bricks are brought on nowadays. Well, these were a sort of similar sort of thing that carried about 5 mines at a time. And I used to find evidence like that lying around. It was interesting, if you took the trouble to look, you could often have a 90% idea of what was in the minefield. And after you'd got your datum points out, you could almost say there will be a certain number of mines in it. In fact, I had one case where I sent an NCO back because I said the minefield wasn't cleared, and he found 2 more mines.
Did they lay them diamond shaped?
Yes. It's logical. When you think of tanks advancing, it has to be diamond shaped to catch them whichever way they attempt to jig.
So you have marked minefields. In retreat, did they just scatter mines willy-nilly?
Oh, yes. In retreat, it's a different matter. I've even found the mines open on the roads, and probably a machine gun fixed so that they can shoot the first sappers down that came to tackle them. But when they were opened like that, I must say that when I was with the Canadians didn't even wait for us to come up. They used to just drive forward with tanks and flail tanks and the rest and just blow them. There weren't people who would hang about.
The telemine, you've described the shoe mine and the S mine.
Yeah.
What did the telemine look like? What a size and shape?
Oh, so telemine is about the size of a dinner plate. It's got a slightly domed shape, and the centre, it will be around about four inches deep, five inches possibly deep. And it acts on the same principle as every other mine. The tank goes over and presses the top plate down, which is on a kind of, you might call it a pan, a flat pan. Presses it down on it, there's a spring inside which activates it, and away it goes. There were extras with the even with the telemine, they could fasten a booby trap underneath it, screw a booby trap underneath it. Their fuses were very interesting. In fact, the difference to me between the British and the Germans was astonishingly revealed in the mines. The British mines had no safety devices. The German mines and fuses all had at least one and generally two safety devices. Very interesting.
So if you lifted a German mine and knew where the safety device was, you could...
Oh yes, I did regularly.
And that would clear the cross.
Yes.
But with a British mine, you couldn't.
I had a distressing experience later. We're jumping the gun a bit, if you like. But when we were clearing a minefield behind Boulogne, behind where the Channel Tunnel is now, Sangat, one of my troops, and I had always said, one man, one mine, or one man, one bomb. And when one was exposed, I used to make the remainder of the unit retreat